Bloody Elbow presents the MMA Vivisection, the show that gives you a comprehensive breakdown and expert analysis of all the fights happening on this weekend's UFC card. Here are your hosts, Zane Simon and Connor Rebush.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush. We are here once again talking about this week's UFC card, going down at the Moody Center in Austin, Texas. I'll tell you, Connor, sometimes I feel like a Moody Center.
I knew something dreadfully corny was coming after that. Just the tone.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. Sometimes I feel a little moody, and that's when I put on the sweet sounds of Charles Mingus. You're listening to WKAQ.
You need to see the wrong guy at some point, because then you can get my joke of... That was some kind of jazz. I'm not your usual radio announcer today.
That's a good ass joke. That was some kind of jazz.
Sounds good. Anyway, we're here talking about this week's fight night card. Calvin Kattar, Josh Emmett, great card, great fights. And we're talking about the prelims right now with a featured prelim between Adrian Yanez and now I've forgotten her name, and Andrea Lee's new racist boyfriend.
That's right.
So the prelims honestly pretty great too, gotta say. I don't know why they've decided to put a whole bunch of fun and known fighters on the prelims of a fight night card, but I will take it.
Maybe they just don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a total crapshoot every time.
Are
these good fights?
Sean Shelby's out there just with like some 20-sided dice, just like rolling his way through to, you know, each fighter gets a number. And he's got like 5 dice, so he can create like a whole bunch of different number combinations.
I mean, for all we know, they thought that the home Vieira card was just stacked.
It's true, yeah.
Just can't tell the difference.
Right.
These are good prelims. And Yanez Kelly is a very good fight.
It really is, honestly. Two dudes that I did not have nearly as high expectations for as they have proven capable of in the UFC.
I can see that with Kelly, but Yanez looked like pretty damn good from the jump, didn't he?
He looked like a young veteran from the jump.
Yeah.
Which is a favorite kind of fighter for you and I.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't necessarily always trust that kind of fighter to go out and win a bunch right away. You know?
Yeah.
Like, he kind of works behind a boxing game. And often a very head-punching forward boxing game. With other tools thrown in at times as needed, he picks his spots on those carefully. But if I'm not assuming that Yana, you know, he's lost before, and if I'm not assuming that he's the most athletic, decisively, you know, explosive fighter in the division, bantamweight has a lot of dudes that can hang out and take advantage of a fighter working a fairly one-dimensional style.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been a little surprised at how well Yanez has done. And I think it's really a testament to the control that he exerts in his fights.
He's unflappable too.
Like, yeah.
He has the better element of being a young veteran, which is like, instead of just thinking, okay, like survive, it's more like, oh, none of this matters that much.
Yeah.
He has the sort of poise of somebody who's been doing this way longer than they have.
Absolutely.
So you have fights like the Davy Grant one where like a lot of young fighters would go in there and just sort of style on Davy Grant and then just start getting hit with huge punches to the head and the body and freak out a little bit. Just like this bloody faced monster who just won't go away and I've hit him with everything I've got. And Yanez is like, oh, this kind of sucks, and I'm going to figure it out with defense. And then he was like, I guess I'll just win the third round with my jab.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. That's how boxing's supposed to work, whether it's MMA or boxing. You come up with your solutions. You already have all the working parts of your game. You just have to figure out how to place them, what to do when. He's a very solid, well-rounded fighter, despite only having like the one thing he really likes to do.
Yeah, and it's impressed me. You know, I am 100% here to be surprised and impressed by that. Because
always,
you know, even like Jorge Masvidal didn't have it that smooth that early in his career. He was very much the kind of fighter who would go out and like have a couple moments of success and just ride on that feeling of success.
Yeah.
To a loss where he'd just be like, well, I had the bigger moment. I hurt you that one time in the second round and you never hurt me like that. So I was basically winning all the way through.
Yeah.
And Yanez seems to have a much better head for making sure that he turns rounds in his favor with his offense.
Mm-hmm. He either goes for the kill or he actually shuts you out.
Yeah. And I think part of that, too, is just because he's much more dedicated to pressure fighter.
Sure.
Now he's facing Tony Kelly, who I was, you know, suitably impressed by and then suitably unimpressed. I mean, I'm not here to talk about the controversy stuff. That's him being a complete idiot and... We're trying to focus on him as a fighter, and his last performance was very impressive.
He's a solid fighter. I mean, his that debut with Kai Kamaka was like one of the greatest unheralded fights in the last 5 years. Really, really good fight. And he's kind of just maintained that that approach. He's hyper aggressive. He's crafty in an all offense all the time kind of way.
Yeah, he seems to have channeled in that if he's not going to be the most technical fighter in the fight, and if he's going to be hard to hurt, like he's never been knocked out. Mm-hmm. I don't know how badly was he ever dropped during that Kamaka fight. Let me see.
I'm not sure he was. He just ate a ton of punches.
He's never been dropped. He's never, you know, he doesn't seem to get hurt. It seems like he's realized, well, if I'm not going to get hurt, I should make the other person as uncomfortable as humanly possible.
Right.
And, you know, that, like, we talk a lot about the MMA, the evolution of the MMA meta, and Tony Kelly is, you know, he's out there playing some game theory. Like,
yeah.
He is 100% invested in working the MMA game as hard as he can.
Just look into those eyes. That's a game theorist right there.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I can see that having some success against Giannis. Because, sure. Like, you know, again, Davy Grant threw him for a bit of a loop with some just crazy pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And all out offensive. And then it's tempting to look at their two fights with Randy Costa.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, like Tony Kelly's fight was better.
Mm-hmm.
Randy Costa didn't have like a moment in that fight. He was just like uncomfortable and freaking out the entire time. Meanwhile, he had like 3 minutes of just blasting Yanez with jabs and kicks.
Yeah.
But styles make fights. Neither of these guys is fighting Randy Costa. They're fighting each other. And what happens if Tony Kelly does to Yanez what he did to Costa, what he does to everyone, is I assume he is going to force Yanez to hit him back.
Yeah.
And Yanez he may prefer to pressure, but he's, as I said, extremely poised under fire.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't overexert himself, doesn't panic. Also rarely gets hurt. He's very tough, I think largely because he's so calm and he sees everything coming before it hits him. And just a great counterpuncher, super quick with his hands, very technical. I think Kelly, this might be a fight where he bites off a little more than he can chew.
Yeah.
I think Yanez is just like a more disciplined, more consistent version of like Kai Kamaka as an opponent. And that was like a super tough fight where yeah, again, Kelly wins with his doggedness.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know if that's the kind of thing that takes Giannis out of his element. If anything, I think he's shown now several times that you just come at him harder and he is just going to fight back harder.
You look at the losses that Giannis has picked up over his career to Miles Johns, Domingo Pilarte. I can't actually say that I've gone and watched the Levi Moles fight or know how Moles fights. But at least those latter losses are to strong grapplers and strong wrestlers. People who could really take Giannis off of his game, I would assume, that way. You know, split.
Kind of. I got Levi Moles also beat Tony Kelly.
Small world.
He beat him, he lost to Kelly by split immediately after beating Giannis.
Oh, there you go.
But judging by his results, he is a submission grappler.
Yeah. And, that's not a part of Kelly's game. Yeah. He got pretty easily out-wrestled by Kamaka. He did a lot of clinching with Randy Costa,
mm-hmm.
but it was not really to any effective end. It just made Costa uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he could have some success with that with Giannis. If he just goes out and goes after him, throws all the punches he can in the world, holds him on the fence a bunch, he can make this fight really ugly and hard to score. But it is hard not to think that he's going to be eating the bigger shots throughout. And it'll be on him to break Giannis in a way that Giannis doesn't break and hasn't broken yet.
Yes.
And yeah, I got to pick Giannis. I am worried because I do think the way Kelly fought Costa is, it's also one of the things I will say is that I think we're seeing some clear, quick progression from Kelly, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, that Kamaka fight, yeah, he came out and he pressed hard and he was kind of a wild man about it. But it was not... It felt a bit wild and out of control. And the Ali Al-Kaizi fight was slow, kind of ugly, maybe an overcorrection from the Kamaka fight, maybe just a reaction to Al-Kaizi's great wrestling. But the Costa fight did feel like Kelly just sort of finding the exact right formula. And it could just be a stylistic thing, but it also just looked very determined.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just went out and he was like, no, I know how to take this guy apart. I know exactly what I need to do to beat this guy. And, I like to see that.
Sure.
I like to see that kind of dedication and that kind of, that kind of appearance of problem solving, at least. So, I wonder if what Kelly's going to come out like in this fight, if he's going to come out and it's just going to be wild, unchecked aggression, or if it's going to be something that he's, looked a little more at Giannis's fights and figured out what seems to frustrate him most. But, yeah, I'll pick the slicker technician and the guy who doesn't seem, he seems very unfazed. Likely to be unfazed by the kind of fight Kelly wants to have.
Right.
Odds on the bout. Kelly is a sizable underdog. Open at plus 285, just adjusted up and down to plus 308. It's currently down at plus 250. Giannis opened at minus 350, dropped down to minus 382, and is currently minus 323.
I think that's a bit too wide.
I think that's a reaction to Kelly's personality. Which
that, really is, that could quite possibly be it too.
Yeah.
Although I don't know. The
MMA gambling community seems like the least likely community to be like, wow, that guy is xenophobic, I don't know. I can't roll with that.
I think the MMA gambling community is very much in line with, oh, things didn't go the way I wanted. How about a spiteful excuse?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, you see, you tend to in fact see that a lot from gamblers.
Yeah.
They'll be like, oh, this fighter that I was betting on lost. And then they'll go on his Twitter like, you suck. I hate you. You know? Yeah. Like, and that's essentially what Tony Kelly was doing. He was pissy because Lee was getting beaten and then blamed it on a, all Brazilians are cheaters. That's why we're losing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. But it's too wide. I mean, Tony Kelly's a good fighter. He's proven that already. And Yanez, even looking great and coming up with wonderful solutions, has still been in plenty of hard fights. It's not like he's blowing people of this level out of the water.
Yeah. And, the loss to Kai Kamaka for Tony Kelly, like the loss to Kai Kamaka and Kevin Aguilar, both at featherweight. And Yanez isn't going to take Tony Kelly down five times, I don't think.
No.
Which is what part of what Kai Kamaka had to do to get the win.
True.
So, yeah. I mean, if the meta game is pace, Kelly has a lot of it. And Yanez can I think Yanez can meet it. I think he can do the what we would like to see out of modern judging, score the bigger shots as being worth more, as more valuable. But it could be a very tough fight to score.
Mm-hmm. Just checking numbers out of curiosity. The most Giannis has ever landed was in that Davy Grant fight. That's unsurprising. He landed 100 of 255 thrown.
Yeah.
Kelly's was in that Kai Kamaka fight. Landed 114 of 226.
Yeah. So
we're looking at pretty similar outputs. I mean, so I think there's enough reason to pick Giannis, just thinking, he's already had a big crazy guy who kind of just relentlessly came at him. And should here's how he responded.
Yeah. Should be noted, though, in that fight with Randy Costa, Tony Kelly did throw 218 strikes in a round and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
super aggressive performance.
Like I say, that fight to me, that was like one of those things I was like, wow, you know, this is a step forward. Like, this is somebody really looking at how MMA is, you know, trending and being like, I am going to game this system.
Yeah. But since you mentioned it before, I also do think it has something to do with styles.
Yeah.
I think that so. If Giannis had like forced himself, or I'm not sure if he's capable, but if somebody with Giannis's skills had forced himself to just go forward and create a brawl from moment one, he probably also could have broken Randy Costa sooner.
Yeah.
I think Randy Costa hates that. So
Costa fights with a lot of nerves and he fights fast out of the gate to get those nerves out of the way. And that means he can shock some people, but Tony Kelly, like I said, Tony Kelly just knew, it looked like he knew exactly what was going on in Randy Costa's brain and was like, I can screw this guy from moment one. If I just go out there and jump on him from the opening beat of this, and if I start faster than him, he's going to have all of that panic that he's trying to channel out, he's going to fall right back in on him.
Yep. But yeah, anyway, the point being, it's too wide. Tony Kelly's a good fighter. It's going to be a tough fight.
It is. All right. Woman's flyweight bout, Jasmine Jesuda Vicious, Natalia Silva, and I don't really understand this booking. Kay Hansen's a pretty good fighter. Jesuda Vicious beating her was a pretty good result. And Natalia Silva she's just somebody making her debut. Like, she's a 12-5 debut fighter who's 5'4" and like probably fighting in the wrong division. I think really, you know, she backs herself up and just tends to try to have to brawl her way out of pressure on the feet. And then she otherwise relies on being the bigger, stronger fighter in the cage. And Jesuda Vicious, like, Kay Hansen is a pretty decent, you know, like I said, she's a pretty decent fighter. And she found out pretty quickly that consistently trying to clinch up and grapple with this 5'7" woman was a bad idea all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The best part of Jesuda Vici
is just huge for the division.
Yep. And the best part of her game is her top game from guard. She's a really good ground and pound artist on top. So I just don't, you know, I will have to be really impressed by things I have yet to see out of Natalia Silva.
Yep. Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. There's no reason not to pick Jessica Vecius here. She's huge. She's likes to pressure against somebody who retreats too easily. She's going to get top position. And it's not even just from guard. I mean, from any position. She's got a really, really great feel for even in like what in jiu-jitsu might be thought of as like transitional positions of just trapping somebody halfway between two places where they don't want to be, but it's even worse in the middle and then smashing them. She's really nasty on top.
Yep.
Easy pick.
I opened at minus 260, jumped up to minus 250, dropped all the way back down as low as minus 267, but has climbed steadily up to minus 252 since then. Natalia Silva opened at plus 220 and is currently down at plus 202. I don't really see a reason those odds should be getting much shorter.
No.
Jesuda Vecius, like, she just beat a better fighter. And if her only loss is a split decision to Elise Reed, that actually has looked only like a better loss over time.
True, yeah.
Elise has shown some surprising quality in the UFC to date. All right, that brings us to a welterweight bout, Court McGee, Jeremiah Wells, and this is kind of a tougher fighter to call, a tougher fight to call than I want it to be.
Yeah, it's a pretty classic kind of pairing.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Jeremiah Wells is like clearly the much better athlete on the upside. It's just he fights in a style that he's fighting in a style that is most likely to give Court McGee the best opportunity to win.
What style is that?
It is just constant blitzing crashes into the pocket, into double legs, into body lock, into clinch exchanges and takedowns to get on top and just play a power top game from you know, from those crashes. But it's really he's based on crashing.
Yeah. He's a mess, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
He's an absolute mess, especially on the feet.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those guys too. He may not even be a particularly great technical grappler.
Yeah.
But he's very strong and he hits very hard. And when he's connected to his opponent, those things are just overwhelming for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's also responsible for one of the funniest things I've ever seen in the cage. So I got to hand that to him. Remember he did his move against Blood Diamond?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He came out and decided to just do a full, he decided to do a lap.
Yeah.
And then tripped. And got his foot caught in the cage and almost got KO'd for a completely pointless. That's what you do when you have no style. You go into the fight, you're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Maybe I'll run in a circle.
Yeah, big Spike Carlisle vibes.
Big time. I mean, I am inclined to lean towards Court McGee here because you have to be like a really damn good wrestler typically to consistently out wrestle Court McGee.
Yeah. If you are constantly just hooking up and wrestling with Court McGee, most fighters that ends up leading to them getting tired and him not getting tired.
And honestly, even if you are a very damn good wrestler, Sean Brady got Court McGee down twice. What do the stats say? 42 seconds of control for Sean Brady.
Yeah.
Who's a great grappler and a strong wrestler. Most people who get McGee down, he's just a really strong scrambler and difficult to get down in the first place. And so if it just becomes like a, oh, I'm going to try to go blah and run forward and swing both hands at you, Akort McGee is a better boxer now than he ever has been.
Yeah.
He's pretty sharp, actually. He's got a really consistent jab. And I just really like the way that he will also, like, in those empty spaces between blitzes, put a really sort of slow, suffocating pressure on somebody like Jeremiah Wells. And I really like Akort McGee's use of feints as well. He's just a much trickier fighter to read. Like, it took him a long time, but I think he's figured out that when you're slow and not particularly athletic, you have to use craft to prevent the opponent from just seeing your intentions. And he does it really well now. Like, in the Brahimi fight, in the Carlos Condit fight even, and I know it was a loss, even against Sean Brady, another loss where he had a really strong performance, he will just confuse his opponent's timing with just these little subtle feints. And then that's all it takes to make a really basic combination from a not particularly impressive athlete very difficult to time. And I'm going to pick Akort McGee because Jeremiah Wells is a mess, and I think he's probably too used to just being able to overwhelm people with the power and the aggression. Akort McGee has seen all that.
Yeah.
And I suspect, in fact, that Jeremiah Wells may start having a very bad time the moment it becomes clear that that's not going to work. Because I don't know that he knows how to do anything else.
Yeah. No, I mean, his offense really is almost entirely functions around his ability to crash in and bully people.
Yeah.
And get them to fade.
Yeah. And it might work a bit. It probably will. Yeah.
I mean,
but it's Akort McGee is going to figure that out.
Yeah. It should be noted that Akort McGee does, even with craft, he does struggle with people who can consistently punch bigger than him.
Sure.
You know, he has a tough time. It was one of the problems with Carlos Condit was just, he couldn't land hard enough shots to stop Carlos Condit's flow the way other fighters have been able to lately.
Yeah.
And when he couldn't, like Carlos Condit, he actually let Carlos Condit have something close to a classic Carlos Condit fight.
It's true.
So, and the guys that he's otherwise beating are really uncomfortable, prolonged strikers. Guys like Ramiz Brahimaj, Claudio Silva.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go back to 2018, Alex Garcia, but even Alex Garcia is somebody who threw one strike at a time and then would try to get you to the mat.
Even Sean Brady, who, again, I know he lost to, but
yeah,
even Sean Brady, I think it was as close as it was because he's not comfortable in those drawn out exchanges.
Yeah. And that is kind of who Jeremiah Wells is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a lot faster and more explosive with his stand-up in those, like, he's not comfortable in long exchanges, but his sort of natural style is to, like, blitz in with punches, clinch, back off, blitz in with punches, clinch, back off. Like, there's a system to that kind of, to his stand-up game with that discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
He's built a stand-up style that works for him uncomfortably. In a way that somebody like Ramiz Brahimaj or Claudio Silva have never been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a part of me that worries a little bit about that. I think I'm still going to pick Akort McGee, though, just because he doesn't get knocked out.
Yeah.
You know, and if he doesn't get knocked out, it's only Santiago Ponzinibbio that was able to TKO, who's a much more technical striker than Wells could ever be. I think he can just make this fight difficult enough that Wells starts to fade. Because the way Wells fights, the amount of tension he fights with, you have to think at some point he's going to start. If Akort McGee gets on top of him for a while,
yeah,
he's just going to be able to make him fade.
Which could very well happen just in some.
Yeah.
Crazy scramble. Again, McGee's a really strong scrambler.
But it feels like a it feels like a weird pick, honestly, because Wells is far and away the more dynamic athlete. And
I'm perfectly comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Unlike you, Zane, I don't get all googly-eyed and start drooling when I see some guy with an 8-pack. You know? I look at Court McGee. He's got a weird Amish beard. He's perpetually kind of flabby in the middle. I'm like, that's the guy. I have faith in that man.
And, you know, I probably knew this before, but I had forgotten and only just realized it looking again. His name really is Courtney.
That's his given name.
Courtney Scott McGee.
There you go. No wonder he goes by such a weird name as Court.
Yeah.
I always wondered.
No wonder he fights for a living, too.
Yeah. Come on, man.
It's a boy named Sue all over.
Courtney McGee, that dude can't be destroyed by anyone. No one is going to terrify him now. He's been through it.
Yeah.
I like how we're imagining, by the way, that Courtney has been a more damning aspect of his life than heroin addiction. He famously recovered from after, you know, dying of an OD.
Yeah, I mean, the man is no question, no way you slice it. The man is tough.
Oh, my God. Are we supposing that the Courtney probably led to the heroin before the fighting?
I'm not going to even, you know what? I'm not going to speculate. All I'm saying is that the boy named Sue is very much what's going on here.
My name is Connor, and it's not even a woman's name, but it is kind of an annoying guy's name. And I am pretty close to trying heroin. So I can't imagine if I'd been named Courtney, what kind of things, kind of paths my life might have taken.
All right. Court McGee opened at +150. It's currently down at -123. Wells opened at -175. He's currently at +100. I like it. I like seeing it. All right. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Ricardo Hamosh, Danny Chavez, and... this is a fun fight, too.
Another solid fight.
Yeah, Chavez is definitely one of those dudes that should just be getting as many difficult bookings as the UFC can throw at him, because he's 35, and he's been, even if he hasn't been fighting that often, he's been in the game since 2010. You know, Chavez very much entered the UFC a complete fighter. And that fighter is really fast, kicks really hard. He's really consistently well-schooled and just has some miserable, deep-seated flaws, mental flaws in his game.
Mm.
Notably that he can be pushed backwards without a lot of trouble, and that he can be tricked into competing in whatever kind of fight you want to have with him. You can get Danny Chavez to wrestle and grapple with you if you start wrestling and grappling with him.
Yeah. I don't even know if I would call them, I'm not even 100% sure they're purely mental flaws. I think he's missing some basic techniques.
Could be that too.
I think he strikes me as a, just as a type. He is exactly the kind of guy you expect from somebody who is probably, you know, like small camp.
Yep.
Great athlete.
MMA masters to be.
Bingo.
Yeah.
You're at a camp where you can just style on a lot of other dudes. You are a fantastic athlete, and your camp has equipped you with a couple of like. The MMA Masters fighters all seem to view each given strike as like a special move.
Yeah.
That bears no relation to any other part of the game. It's not connected. It's the calf kick, Jim.
Yeah.
I think that just sounds like Danny Chavez. Like Danny Chavez getting backed up looks no different from like Colby Covington now getting backed up. Like there's just a huge gap where it's like, what am I supposed to do if he just doesn't like backing up and kicking, Zane?
Yeah.
Bad approach.
Yeah.
You have to be really, really good with your footwork to make that happen. And you have to fill that space with so many other things. You have to have all these feints and jabs. You have to be a master of positioning. And I just don't think Danny Chavez is. So no. I think it's the fact that you can draw him in into any fight is completely true. I think it's tied to the fact that you can kind of back him up if you're determined to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think all of those things stem from the fact that he's a really great athlete with a really underdeveloped striking game.
That's fair. However you want to slice it, that's a really good reason for me to pick Ricardo Hamosh.
Yes, yes it is.
Hamosh is a fighter that you have to scare him.
Yeah. Hamosh is the guy with the weird mental hangups, in my opinion.
True. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of it in terms for Chavez, just in that, like, I can see, like, you see the athleticism, you see the technical acumen with which he throws his kicks and with which he throws his strikes. And I think of, like, if he's getting backed up this easily and if he's getting drawn into other fights, it's just got to be a lack of focus. But it may, just as you say, it may be that there are just fundamental footwork pieces missing from his game that force him, because of the kind of fight he wants to have, it forces him out into worse fights. It's like we're talking with Steve Garcia, who ended up getting knocked out last week, about how, you know, you're saying Steve Garcia is a wild mess. I'm like, I think there's just a couple of really specific things Steve Garcia wants to do, and they all lead him into a messy fight.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to go in there and he wants to throw short hooks inside and then hit takedowns off of them to get to top control positions where he can do damage. And being a little slow and being a little off balance and not having a lot of range setups, it just walks him straight into the teeth of his opponent's offense every time.
Right.
And he has to then try to brawl his way out, and things get messier and wilder from it. So, you're kind of we're talking like the same kind of flaws from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, with Hamosh, you have to kind of be able to break him when he's doing his thing.
Yeah.
That's what has to happen with Hamosh, because he's going to come out and he looks like a good athlete. He's got good rangy strikes. He will chain really well to body locks and trips and standing back takes. There's a lot of similarities to him and like Charles Oliveira's old game, except that Ricardo Hamosh can see, so he can actually hit you from deep from range and doesn't have to just walk straight into you.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, like, it's funny because I wonder if being blind has actually, like, long-term improved Charles Oliveira, because he's had to build this pocket striking style that's so varied and so confident that you can't throw him off of it. Whereas Hamosh, like, he can see, he can go out there and, like, hit you with a nice 1-2 from distance and some good kicks and an overhand and stuff like that. And that's kind of where his striking has stopped.
Yeah. Largely. He gets hit. He doesn't have to step forward immediately just to find out who it was who hit him.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's there?
Yeah.
Oh, we're clinching. Yeah, no, that is an interesting thought. Yeah, that he does not have the same. I mean, Hamosh is often confused me because he seems to have very few tangible limitations.
Yeah.
He seems like he should be a really, really good fighter.
Yep. But what tends to happen is he'll duck in on a body lock, hit the takedown, get to a back take, and then if his opponent fights off the submission, his heart starts to fail him.
Yeah. I will say I do get the sense that, like Charles Oliveira, he's starting to push through that a bit.
Yeah. I think the fight he had with Zubar Chukugov.
Oh my god.
It was a great step, but it also still showed some flashes of the same limitations wherein he had somebody, whenever Chukugov would just come forward at him, he found it, he had to, like, really muster up the courage to figure out how to fight him off and push him back. And he did it over and over again, but it was a struggle every time.
Right. And it could go, a fight like that could go either way for him, like psychologically. Cause like,
yeah.
he could think, well, that I would have gotten blown out of the water in that fight another time if he could be that honest with himself.
Yeah.
And look, I did so much better. Or, and this seems just as likely, unfortunately, he could say, well, the fight was terrible and uncomfortable and I was having a miserable time and I fought back like I never had before and I still lost.
Yeah.
I would hope that it's the beginning, because Oliveira had a lot of these little moments on his come up where it was like, mm-hmm. I still think he's a quitter inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, Hamosh was incredibly tough to break in that Tokugawa fight. And Tokugawa was fighting uncharacteristically aggressive for much of it.
Yep.
Really staying on him and beating him up. So I would really like to see Hamosh come out of that able to fulfill his potential.
Either way, though, I think Chavez is just going to give him a lot of the fight he wants.
Yeah.
And with that, when you do that with Ricardo Hamosh, he wins a lot of the fight he wants.
Yep. Yep. He's got reach. He's fast. He's a creative striker. I just don't think the retreating kicking game is a great strategy to try against him.
Yeah.
I'm totally with you.
Yep.
And the fact that Hamosh will happily step in after strikes and grab Chavez, and Chavez will have to grapple with him because he doesn't know how to get off the fence.
Yep. And because he's willing to accept a grappling game.
Yeah, both of those. I mean, both are true for sure.
Yep.
And it's both of them are bad against Hamosh.
Yep.
Should be fun while it lasts. I mean, Chavez is a super tough out just because he's so fast. And we have seen him in some horribly messy fights where he will just go down swinging. But
yep.
The shape seems to favor Hamosh.
Hamosh is a big favorite here, opened at -310, jumped up as high as -289, but is back down to -317. Chavez opened at +260, dropped all the way down to +229, is currently up at +245. All right, that brings us to a women's strawweight bout, Maria Oliveira, Gloria De Paula, and take it away.
On the one hand, I don't care.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, this should probably be pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, both women, I think, have found themselves getting challenged with the fact that they just like to scrap.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a prototype. It's almost sort of a prototypical thing now that we've seen for several years for women coming off of the Brazilian MMA circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's something about it that just seems to imbue a very specific kind of attitude in these fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Where like there just seems to be a wealth of very angry small women in Brazil who desperately want to hit somebody really, really hard. You know, like even somebody like Tabitha Ricci, who's like this jiu-jitsu black belt world champ, is just like coming into the UFC being like, I just want to go out there and like throw overhand rights at people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even Mackenzie Dern, who is only like faked her way to Brazilianness, has like adopted that as her career has gone on.
Her way to Brazilianness.
You're one
of these guys now too, Zane, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I've been outraged by her misophonia.
I'm Mackenzie Dern's white knight on this matter. I think it's silly that people get upset about that.
No, I know it's bullshit. I just
get over yourself, Zane.
Either way, both these women have kind of come to the UFC with these very scrappy, brawly games that struggle at this level, frankly, and they're finding that out rapidly.
Sure. And more than that, I think it will be fun because they both have a very similar frame.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both kind of lanky and tall. And especially with fighters who are already allergic to not scrapping, that tends to lead to a scrap in MMA. Yeah. Like, you know, you get something like that in other combat sports and different things arise. But like in MMA, when two southpaws fight, when two tall, long fighters fight, anytime two strikers who are used to being insulated by some aspect of their physiology meet somebody who has the exact same insulation and they realize it doesn't work, they scrap.
Yep.
It's a scrappy sport.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it'll be a pretty fun fight. I have a little more faith in Gloria DePaola because I think she has a little bit of defense.
Yeah, I also think that her two UFC losses have
looked taught her
something. Like that
yeah.
The fight she had against Diana Belpita, she looked like a more consistent, controlled fighter who was ready to land and chamber her strikes, land them and like reset.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than just keep on swinging wilder and wilder.
Yeah, on the one hand, it was like it was one of those fights that was like I couldn't even appreciate how exciting it was. It was. If I wasn't a dork, I would look at that fight and be like, "This is great."
Yeah.
These two women are just throwing down the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm an insufferable dork, I look at it and I'm like, "Why are we having the same exchange over and over again?"
Yeah.
Why is no one learning? Why is nothing changing? Clearly, and neither of you hit hard enough to break the other. So, like, why is no one trying to find the appropriate counter to what's happening? But given that, Belpita is a very tough fighter to stand in there, go toe to toe with, and just trade shots. And I did actually, I liked Belpita's showing because I liked how often she went to the body. That was great. But for DePaola, she stayed super composed in these crazy exchanges. Kept her guard up, and I thought did a really good job of picking her spots, when to let her hands go, and as you said, then just like a small little pivot or just pulling back over her stance, back to the guard, reset.
Yep.
She looked really stable, and hence it was an incredibly stable brawl where like nothing was gained, nothing was learned. It was essentially a dead even fight, though.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have been upset if DePaola won because I thought nobody won. It was just the same fight for 15 minutes straight. And meanwhile, I don't think that Maria Oliveira has had a – I mean, she had the one UFC fight, right, with Ricci.
Yep, with Ricci, yep.
And was just kind of supremely uncomfortable the whole time. It's impossible to say whether she's learned anything from that or not. But I just think she's a little more frenetic.
Yep.
And I think especially put into a fight where her reach isn't – just going to keep the opponent away where she can still be touched. I think that's going to make her very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I agree DePaola. On all counts. I'm taking DePaola as well. Should be a fun scrap.
Honestly. Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, on a card like this, where I'm actually like, without even having to research, interested in like 70% of the fights, then I would totally take just a meaningless scrap.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, we talk about it all the time. Your best cards, they get a little of everything. You get some, you can have a totally slow grinding dud fight that I will happily enjoy if it's in the middle of an awesome card full of other awesome fights.
Like, yeah, you won't skip through it. You won't walk away. You'll be like, oh, the last fight was something. Now I got something else. This is going to make the next war more entertaining.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a place for this fight on this card, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, odds on the bout. Let's see, Gloria DePaola is the favorite here. Opened at minus 175, dropped to minus 250, is currently at minus 265. Oliveira opened at plus 150, jumped up to plus 211, is currently plus 210. That's wide. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a fight I could easily see just coming down to a razor-thin split decision.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking for Gloria DePaola. Her crowning moment is having the same exchange over and over against Diana Belpita.
Yeah.
Whose only UFC win is Hannah Goldie, who has, like, the shortest arms in the division. And otherwise got cooked by Cheyenne Vlismas. And... held down by Jin Yu Frey.
Yeah.
And
Jin Yu Frey is like now increasingly rare UFC win.
Yeah. And Maria Oliveira may not look, you know, she may have just lost to Tabitha Ricci, and it may not have been a special looking fight or performance from her, but she has double the experience that Gloria DePaola has.
Yeah. There's just no reason for DePaola to be a favorite.
Like
a big favorite.
No, These women have both not finished fights by strikes before. They both are scrappy. They're both the same height. And I think this might be for both of them as well. Let's see, actually. I'm trying to think. Were their last fights at strawweight, the Belbita fight? Okay, no. This is not the strawweight debut for both of them. Never mind. So, not important. No point to be made. Let's move right on to a sad fight. Like I said, the card gets to have a little of everything. And this is the sad fight that we don't need.
Yeah.
A bantamweight bout between Eddie Wineland and Cody Stamann. And
it just feels like a keeping Stamann relevant as a gatekeeper kind of matchup, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's just one of those things where, like, Eddie Wineland doesn't have it anymore.
Yeah. And Stamann's one of these guys where, like, you know he's good. You can see it in every single fight. I mean, granted, the last one was over a little too quickly to tell, but typically every time out, but he's on a 3-fight losing streak.
Yeah.
You can tell he's still more or less at the top of his game. So what else do we do?
Yeah.
But feed him any Eddie Wineland.
Yeah, I get it. I just, like, it sucks because this was always going to be what happened to Eddie Wineland.
Let me say this. What is Cody Stamann's path to victory here? Is he going to knock Eddie Wineland out?
I think it's very likely. I know he's not a big puncher, but that kind of makes it all the sadder to me.
Sure. All I'm saying is, not only not a big puncher, not a very high output striker.
No.
Not super aggressive with his hands. Cody Stamann, the best part of Cody Stamann's game is his wrestling.
Yeah.
And Eddie Wineland, I assume, is still very difficult to out-wrestle. So there may be a little bit more life in this matchup than I thought first looking at it. Because now that I think about it, I'm like, what does it look like if Cody Stamann decides, I'm going to walk Eddie Wineland down and knock him out? It's probably still not very easy for him.
It might not be. It's true. But that, like I say, it just kind of makes it, like, I just don't have any faith left in Eddie Wineland.
No, I mean, why would you? But
yeah, getting wrecked by John Castaneda.
Yeah.
Who, I like John Castaneda, but also not a big puncher. You know?
No. I mean, he dropped Miles Johns a few times, didn't he?
Sure.
Before submitting.
Maybe he's learning to be a bigger puncher.
Yeah, maybe that's something to take away from it if you want to defend Eddie Wineland.
Yeah, but just, I mean, this was always going to be what happened to Eddie Wineland, though.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, of course. Even that fight with Grigory Popov, where he had some amazing moments, he was still
getting rocked constantly.
Barely holding on.
Yeah.
That fight could have easily been won in a 5-fight losing streak.
And you have to remember, too, that he did also just get out. He didn't get knocked out, but he did just get out-punched by Alejandro Perez.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about, like, how does he lose to a low output, not hard punching fighter?
I'm picking Cody Stamann.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the way that Eddie Wineland, that we're worried about him losing, doesn't exactly fit in with what Stamann really does well.
It's true. It's true. It's just, you know, he's lost enough speed.
Yeah.
That the footwork just doesn't fool anyone anymore.
Yeah.
And without the footwork fooling anyone, then it's a very squared up puncher who spends a lot of time in the pocket with his chin straight in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Stamann too, I think honestly he's been working to be a better puncher lately. Like that fight he had with Merab Dvalishvili, he stood in and he traded a lot of good shots with Merab.
That's true.
I think he knows that he needs to be a bigger puncher. And I think he's working on it. And yeah, I'm just going to pick Cody Stamann, and I'll even pick him to knock him out.
I don't have a particularly good idea of how it plays out, but you just can't pick Eddie Wineland anymore.
Yeah. I think between the takedown threat, even if he doesn't hold Eddie Wineland down,
it's enough to confuse his aging reactions.
Yeah. And
that's true.
With the, you know, the ability, the work he's put in on being a more, you know, a bigger puncher, working on upping his output a bit. I mean, let me see. Let's see if I'm just.
Let's corroborate that.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, he threw 179 strikes against Brian Kelleher.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Deval Javili did really outpace him over the course of that fight pretty well, but it was still, it wasn't an inactive performance from Cody Stamann. Just
no.
It really, with Cody Stamann, it really is just one of those things where if a fighter is more physical and more dynamic than him, they can throw him off his game entirely.
Cody Stamann is like he works best as like a surface for the opponent to bounce off of.
Yeah.
Super low center of gravity, very tough. And good counters, great counter wrestling, very difficult to take down. So like a certain level of athlete, he just like lets them do what they want to do and then answers it.
Yeah, like you look at his fights where he's fought like Brian Caraway, Tarian Ware, Brian Kelleher. When he's fighting lesser athletes,
oh yeah,
he's always up around like nearly 100 strikes landed over a fight,
mm-hmm.
And then you know he doesn't break. He barely breaks 30 when he's fighting somebody who's more athletic than him.
Yes.
But I just don't think at this point that Eddie Wineland is more athletic than him. I think that nope. Cody Stamann's going to feel very comfortable in there.
Yep.
So, unless he just gets the like starstruck jitters, maybe he just has, you know, a lot of people still remember how good Eddie Wineland used to be. Maybe he'll walk in there and be like, I expect the best and just be like frozen. But I don't think so.
No, I just have to assume that Wineland is done and that's enough to beat him.
Yeah. Stamann is a prohibitive favorite. Opened at -275, currently down at -512. Wineland opened at +235, currently up to +371. And just for the sake of my aching heart, Cody Stamann by TKO KO is +270.
Oh. Wow. It would be his seventh ever win by TKO.
Mm-hmm. It's never happened for him before. So,
but it doesn't really happen very often.
But it doesn't happen very often.
He's not really a finisher.
No. All right. That brings us to a middleweight bout. Phil Haas, Duran Win, and
this is it. This is what you do with Phil Haas.
Yeah.
You know, you went in there, he was doing great against Chris Curtis, you took him seriously, and then it was going beautifully, and then he just got KO'd anyway. So you just give him some weird meme fighters.
Yeah.
You're like, well, okay, what if you go against somebody who's also strong, but is like a 5'1"? You know? What happens then? How tall is Duran Win actually? 5'6"? He's legitimately 5 inches shorter than Phil Haas.
Yeah.
Who's not.
5'6" feels like a in shoes kind of measurement too, I gotta say.
Yeah. Honestly. Yeah, I love this matchmaking.
Yeah.
It's a really stupid fight. I don't really know how to make heads or tails of it. But I like the idea of Phil Haas just stop trying to pit him against like good fighters of varying degrees of athleticism. Give him some athletic little dwarf.
You know, I didn't even realize it, though, until they were talking about it. And I was watching the Chris Curtis fight, and I don't think Chris Curtis is actually. And in fact, I'm sure he's not any taller, really. But like
Curtis is short.
Phil Haas is one of the smallest middleweights in the division.
Yeah, he's short. He's just super muscular.
Yeah.
Yeah, Curtis is probably shorter than him, though.
Yeah, I think he probably is. I'm actually just going to check. Phil Haas is listed on Wiki as 5'11", on Tapology as 6 foot. The 5'11 probably feels a little more accurate to me.
Tapology lists him as 5'10".
Curtis, Chris Curtis. 5'10", is. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, probably Phil Halls wins this because Duran Wynn's really only good at wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, I have a basic rule in place that I'm just never going to pick Duran Wynn in the UFC.
Just he's too small.
Yeah, to beat a middleweight. Like, he might do it sometimes because he's very, very tough.
Yeah.
And he is a good, powerful wrestler. But being a tiny wrestler is like being a tiny outfighter. It's not the way it's supposed to work.
True.
You know, you want to be the wrestler that's bigger than everyone. That's the best way to make your wrestling game work.
Yeah. So yeah, probably Phil Halls. Like if he still holds on to the striking improvements that he showed.
Yeah.
Against Chris Curtis. I mean, he really was like that. There were some hinky parts of that. Like Chris Curtis didn't land that counter when he did by accident.
No.
But it was a vast improvement for Halls in just the comfort in putting his strikes together.
Go ahead.
I mean, who knows? The thing is, he's going to have to be aware of the takedowns, and Duran Wynn will throw some really stupid overhand rights.
Yep.
It really could happen because Phil Halls is just like he's just categorically KO-able.
Yeah, I think I've realized what it is that there are two ways that Phil Haas, his attitude in a fight, I think, pivots wildly between one of two settings.
Mm-hmm.
And it is hyper aware of the danger that his opponent possesses to him. And it is hyper unaware. When things are going good for Phil Haas,
yeah,
I think like what we saw in that Chris Curtis fight, the way he was flowing in that fight.
Oh man.
Like he did not have a thought in his mind. Everything
Chris Curtis might hit him.
Everything was just flowing. It was easy.
Right.
It was pure, like just coming out, you know, the muscles are going. He's seeing what he wants. Everything he sees, he hits. And it's just pure flow. And then when something bad happens to him, it becomes the hyper aware. You know, we've seen in other fights where like he has a bad moment and suddenly that feeling of pure, like unaware calm is crushed by hyper aware anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, oh my God, anything could hit me. Anything could hurt me. Yeah. I was not thinking about anything and nothing could hurt. I didn't think anything could hurt me. But now that something has, I think anything could.
Why didn't someone tell me?
Yeah.
No, but it's also probably why he's actually like historically, I mean, I call him KO-able. He's actually pretty hard to finish.
Yeah.
It's just really, really easy to hurt.
Yeah.
And it's. Because he does just go into like lockdown. Okay, I can't let anything else happen for the rest of the fight mode when most of the time he gets hurt.
Yep.
But yeah, I think you're absolutely onto something there. It's a super dramatic version of a syndrome we've talked about often in regards to different fighters, whether it's we talked about it all the time with Bermudez. But it's like I think you're right. He's so hyper focused on being offensive, I mean, almost that he's not honestly focused at all. Like you say, like it's just flow state. He's not even thinking. He's just. And that was the first time we really seen that actually applied to his striking.
Mm-hmm.
Where the striking just looked that easy for him to explore.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't matter. Like if you just, you know, steal yourself and hit him back, then it's going to be the same as ever.
Like, I think it's honestly, like, thinking about it, it's the same thing we saw at Alistair Overeem for all those years.
Sure.
Like, you would see Alistair Overeem look just like a juggernaut in a fight and get caught by something and just instantly shatter. Like he had no idea that anything could be coming.
Yeah. Good comparison. At all.
And then other times, you know, you'd see him get hurt and he would just like shell into the most defensive, like absolutely cowed fighter possible.
Yeah.
And it's Phil Haas has the same kind of thing.
Strong comparison. So it'd be really funny if Daron Wynn did that to Phil Haas, and it could happen because it's Phil Haas.
I mean, Daron Wynn is super tough. And
he really is.
He does not have that problem at all.
He ate flush knees from Antonio Arroyo, a guy who was like a foot and a half taller than him. And he ended that fight just stepping in and trying to bomb on Arroyo. Like he kind of at a certain point was just like, you know what? Enough wrestling. You want to hit me? He just started hitting him back. He's very tough.
He just has, his arms are so short that like, he can't even effectively get into Haas's range. Like,
well,
I mean, it's possible, but like Gerald Meerschaert, like just ended up putting a clinic on Daron Wynn.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so you got to take Phil Haas, but
you got to take Phil Haas, but it is absolutely possible for him to just get clean KO'd 8 minutes into a fight that he is stomping Daron Wynn in.
Yep.
So, all right, odds on that bout: Phil Haas opened at -240, currently down to -269. Daron Wynn opened at +205, dropped down to +190, currently up at +213. That brings us to our final fight of the card, middleweight bout, Roman Dolidze, Kyle Daukaus, and
good thing they stuck it here, you know. Daukaus seems like he should deserve a lot more.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy just got booked in a fight with Kevin Holland, who's right at the tippy top of this card.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem particularly fair.
And then he came back after that no contest in a fight that he looked like he was going to win, I would say, as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like,
that headbutt aside, he had Holland.
We didn't get to see enough, but yeah, it was.
He had Holland very uncomfortable.
He was doing well.
That fight was going. And he came back and he stomped Jamie Pickett. Like, they gave him a layup rebound and he crushed it. It was like the easiest call in the world, but. It's not like he didn't go out and perform the next time they booked him.
Yep. And now he's curtain jerking versus the man with the most hateable face in the entire UFC.
Yeah. Who has a devastating record of incredibly boring fights.
Unbelievably boring fighter. And Daukaus himself is not averse to boring fights.
Yeah.
You know what? Actually, Tapology has this at as the second fight on the card.
Well, I so checked.
It's possible there are like two fights that are in different positions on the Tapology version.
Yeah, I checked with the ESPN Fight Center, and it has the lineup that's on Wiki. But
okay, there you go. That's probably the one then.
Yeah.
So yeah, whatever they did to deserve it, here they are now. Is this you or me?
I think it's me.
Oh, it's you. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, this is the thing with Daukaus, we know, is all parts of his game are going to be in play. Mm-hmm. All parts of his game have to be in play. He can't just go out there and throw hands with somebody. He has to also hit takedowns, and he also has to go for submissions. If he's not doing any one of those things, he will throw himself into them. Even to his own detriment.
Mm-hmm.
His idea of MMA is a complete chain of events where striking leads to wrestling leads to grappling. And that got him losses to Phil Haas and Brendan Allen, even when there were parts of that fight where he was much better suited to win of both fights.
Yep.
And that could be the case against Roman Dolidze. Dolidze is 6'3". He's got size parity with Kyle Daukaus. He is strong. And he is a decent positional grappler when he's on top. So if Daukaus clinches up with him and he's just not as strong as Roman Dolidze, he could end up with Roman Dolidze on top of him and be throwing himself into that kind of fight over and over. That said, Daukaus is a much more functional fighter in just about every other way.
Yeah.
And Roman Dolidze's game is so
awful.
Blank in every horrible. Other way.
Horrible.
Like, I don't even, it just doesn't have, it just doesn't exist. Like, he, at this point, he, now that he's learned that he does not, he's not actually a good striker, like, he just doesn't strike at all anymore. Yeah.
He just stands out there and sneers at you.
Yeah. And he's not a good technical wrestler. He's just kind of a physical bully with his wrestling. So he will, you know, like we had that fight on with against Laureano Staropoli. He just ended up like holding him on the cage and walking in circles with him for three rounds.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have the technique to get him down.
Against someone who literally did not know how to get him off his back.
Yeah. And Daukaus will know how to do that.
Oh, yeah. Daukaus is super well-schooled everywhere.
I have to pick Daukaus here just to create enough offense to win this fight. But it'll be interesting if he just keeps late. Like I say, if Daukaus just keeps running into the clinch and getting, like, scrambling and losing scrambles, I don't know that he'll stop.
Yeah, that's the reason I'm preemptively frustrated with this fight.
Yeah. Because
it is yet another one, in addition to those two you named, Phil Halls and Brendan Allen, where it seems like Daukaus could probably just go out there and beat Dolidze up. Like, Daukaus is a pretty solid striker. He's a better boxer than his brother.
Yeah, unquestionably.
He's got head movement. He puts together nice combinations. They just don't exist as part of their own face. Like, I don't think he's comfortable with it, I just don't. There's like an empty space between combinations that he doesn't know, like, you know, what's like my resetting footwork.
Yeah.
What he knows is you do this, then you're momentarily vulnerable, so you take down.
Yeah.
That's how you fill the gaps, is with other phases, because it's MMA.
Yeah.
And this is another fight where, I feel like he could just probably pressure, which he's been doing a lot more of lately. He could just pressure Dolidze and just punch him and beat him up. And he is undoubtedly going to back Dolidze into the fence and shoot on him. And I don't have a super clear idea of how that plays out. Because, Daukaus is a better technician pretty much everywhere. But Dolidze is very big and strong.
Yeah. And if Daukaus, you know, shoots in and can't get enough drive on the shot and is starting to get flattened out, he might just pull guard.
Yep.
And suddenly he has Dolidze on top of him.
Yeah, so I'm also going to take Daukaus, but obvious reasons for concern. And I would just, this is such an opportunity for Daukaus to just take the win.
Yeah.
And not make it a fight, because there's certain things Dolidze just can't do.
Yep.
But I don't think Daukaus's game functions that way.
Yeah. Definitely feels that way. I mean, it was such a perfect storm for him to get a fight like Pickett, where you have somebody who is just like tense and averse to the stress of a fight.
Yeah.
And then like Daukaus's ability to take all fights to him absolutely broke him immediately. But I don't think that that's going to happen with Dolidze.
No.
All right. Odds on the bout. Daukaus is the favorite here, opened at minus 175, dropped to minus 210, currently down at minus 246. Roman Dolidze opened at plus 150, jumped up to plus 176, currently at plus 198. All right, we're going to wrap things up on that note. You can find me on Twitter at TheZaneSam. You can find Connor on Twitter at BoxingBush. You can find both of us over at BloodyElbow.com. Give us a like, subscribe to our podcast on Bloody Elbow Presents on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all that good stuff. And we'll be back in 1 week's time for UFC Vegas 57, Sarukian versus Gamrot, which is an all right card. It's got some good fights on it.
Mm-hmm.
Great main event. Magni Rachmanov should be fun. you know, Chris Curtis, Rodolfo Vieira, Sir Holly and Paiva. You know, I gotta give a shout out to my scrappy Brazilian bantamweight boy.
Goldberg and Chukwi is gonna be ridiculous.
Yeah, not a lot of high level bookings on it, but some fun fights. All right, on that note, we're gonna sign off. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, as well as subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We are also on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents, and you will get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The MMA Vivisection, The Level Change Podcast, The Sixth Round Post-Fight Show, Sixth Round Retro, The MMA Depressed Us, Crooklyn's Corner, Exclusive Fighter Interviews, Show Money, and radio-style play-by-play for every UFC pay-per-view. Be sure to also follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow, Facebook at facebook.com/bloodyelbowblog, and as always on bloodyelbow.com.